Welcome to the ACIP podcast, the official podcast of the Association for Critical and Interdisciplinary Thinking. We have a somewhat more relaxed intro now, but we are still hoping to provide you with thought-provoking and stimulating conversations with researchers from all kinds of backgrounds and from all over the world. As always, you can find out more about us at www.acid-science.com. And now, without any further ado, let's jump right in. So hello everyone, I'm here with Henrik Jung-Aberle. Thanks a lot for joining us on the ACID Science podcast.
Hello.
So I'll just begin with some introductory words on your background. You are currently the director of the MIND Foundation, a Europe-wide nonprofit dedicated to advancing a rational and science-based discourse around psychedelic research. And you are also CEO of Ovid Health Systems, a relatively new company that is building up clinics for psychedelic therapy in Germany. So yeah, the current period of growth around psychedelics has been coined the psychedelic renaissance, and as director of the MIND Foundation, you're obviously at the forefront of many of these developments. And there's lots to talk about with this topic and many interconnections between topics, so I think we can keep the structure of this conversation relatively loose.
Yes. Thank you for the introduction. I'd just like to add that I spent most of my researcher's life at the medical faculty of the University of Heidelberg, working as a medical psychologist and public health researcher. But even then, I already published some books and papers on psychedelics. So, and that has now become more the center of my activities. Yeah. So, we're very pleased to have that conversation.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, maybe that's also important to mention your background in the like public health sector or in the health sector directly. So yeah, because we need to start somewhere and there are so many things to talk about, I wanted to jump in on a topic that I think is particularly interesting and relevant to our times and that you are mostly involved in now. So the role of psychedelics in psychotherapy and psychiatry. So maybe we can start with your work in the Ovid clinics and the term around augmented psychotherapy and what it means and why it's so relevant.
Yeah, thank you for the question or putting the topic in. So let me just explain to our listeners that psychedelics, of course, are not new to humanity. Psychedelics are a class of substances that have been used for thousands of years, but more in ceremonial contexts and very often also a social, some would call it ritualized context. So it was pretty new though to Western society that in the 1950s that psychedelics have been experimentally used in psychotherapy. So, and these psychotherapies were more psychodynamic, actually psychodynamic practitioners like Sandison, who would involve a psychedelic substance in their psychoanalysis, in the treatment of their clients. Since then, a lot has happened. There has been a youth movement, a counterculture movement, esoteric movement. Psychedelics have been illegalized. A lot of people went underground. And then, since about 10 years, we experienced something that is called psychedelic renaissance. And that means that in dozens of universities worldwide, people are conducting research on psychedelics. Not only universities, also companies. Some of these companies, I would call them small pharma, and some of these companies I would call more clinical companies like our own Ovid clinic. So what are we actually doing here in Berlin? We have opened the first psychedelic augmented psychotherapy clinic in the German-speaking countries. And I'm not talking about illegal psychotherapy practices because I don't count them in the family of these new practices. They have often worked with the theoretical baggage of the 1970s. And now, from our perspective, the game starts anew. So what are we doing? We are at the moment treating people with indications ranging from depression, anxiety, to PTSD. And how are we doing that? We have developed the first protocol. We're just implementing the second one, but the first protocol is ketamine augmented psychotherapy. Now, some of those who are familiar with psychedelic treatment may say, well, that's not new. People are doing that all over the world. But the way we are doing it is very special. We have a 26-hour protocol that people are usually going through. We personalize it, but that's the standard format. And within those 26 hours of psychotherapy, they have five sessions of ketamine. We consider the ketamine sessions psychotherapy too. So that doesn't sound revolutionary to some of the listeners maybe, but it's quite radical when you take a look at the psychedelic landscape, because there you have people who sometimes do some psychotherapy, but often it's only called preparation, dosing session, and then integration. We believe, and there is some evidence, some empirical evidence to that, that one reason why psychedelic therapies might be a game changer or work well for a lot of people is that they increase, they expand, they intensify general change mechanisms in psychotherapy. And that's what we actually do here. I could dive deeper into it, but I'll give it back to you or for your questions. Yeah.
So I think that nicely connects to like a very general question about psychedelics, and that I think is also controversially discussed in the context of the Mind Foundation. So whether psychedelics actually work more on the mind or on the brain. So whether we, like in the context of ketamine that has been widely used since 50 years also as an anestheticum, so there are like different brain mechanisms involved, and ketamine also works differently than the classical psychedelics that work on the serotonin system. So do you, maybe like as a general question, why do you think ketamine actually works? And is like the psychedelic aspect of ketamine therapy more important, or do you think there's also like this more working on the brain, and is the psychotherapy trying to tackle the more the mind aspect and actually working on the psyche of the patients directly, or is it more as a medicine?
Yeah. So you started with a more culture war question, working on the mind, working on the brain. Our readers may know that there are decade-long debates about that. We actually think that the mind and the brain, that's our most common hypothesis, are just two sides of one coin. So we are more a monist, that's how they call it in philosophy, conception of that whole question. Are these two worlds? But more practically, we very decisively work with both perspectives. So we know from research papers and the patient experience that ketamine can very rapidly change a person's psychiatric condition. So people can come out of suicidal ideation or deep depressive states within 3 to 5 days, or sometimes even after the ketamine session. The whole system seems to be metaphorically rebooted. Yeah, but now comes what's different with some university clinics who are doing it all the time, like treating patients on a biomechanistical paradigm with ketamine. We very intentionally target the phenomenological state. So we want to evoke that very special psychedelic state that ketamine and serotonergic psychedelics seem to have in common. So there is like an intersection between the ketamine. Ketamine is a dissociative, and serotonergic psychedelics like psilocybin and LSD or DMT are more acting on the serotonergic side of the neuroreceptor system. But phenomenologically, they share a lot. I would say from our experience of patients talking of what they experience, that at least 80% of the phenomenology is very consistent with what people experience in serotonergics. So they have daydream-like experiences. They have very, very strong changes of body perceptions. So their whole way they perceive their own pain system physiologically, but also psychologically, changes for about 20 to 40 minutes. By the way, we also apply ketamine IV. So people lie down in a calm space, and they are in the presence of a person. So building a relationship and making it clear to the patient that a human being is in the room is a central factor in our therapies. This does not happen in a lot of the university clinics. Very often people are just... the idea in a biomechanistic scheme, ketamine treatment scheme, is that ketamine repairs the brain. While it has that has a direct effect on some depression relevant factors in the brain, the repairing metaphor is simply not complex enough. That's not happening. It's not repairing. And also, people are if you work on that biomechanistical paradigm, a lot of people are having relapses after 5 to 10 days. We experience in our patients that happens much less than in those biomechanistical treatments. So patients are often reporting after 3 months when we apply the HAM-D, that's a measurement of depression again. Some patients still are, they have decreased from maybe 25 to 6 or 25 to 5 when they were very successful patients. And sometimes with the psychotherapy attached, it still stays. Did I answer your question?
That was perfect. Yeah, you phrased it better than me and then you answered it. So that was...
Yeah,
so I also think it's quite an interesting general question of how important it is actually to understand how psychedelics work, like on a more functional level in the brain, and how what the core mechanisms are, and to also understand how to potentially make use of that. So I remember in the context of the MAPS, like MDMA assisted therapies, they talked of this bringing the brain in the perfect like state of excitation, or like the perfect state where you could actually work with people therapeutically. But that, I guess, that underscores your point of saying that you need to have the therapy on top. You bring the people in the right state, but then if you don't do any therapy, that won't have any lasting effects.
Well, it also comes down to how we consider what are human beings. I think the what we call human beings is a very complex system that emerges. There are some emergent phenomena from the physical neurocognitive basis that we see in the brain. And like people are organizing their lives with concepts like that build expectancies, and you can influence these concepts by psychotherapies. Or people are organizing their selves, their egos, and their identity systems through decade-long learning. And how could that possibly be influenced in a targeted way by a very unspecific pharmacological process? I think we have to bring both things together. Yeah, change the underpinning of that emergent system, but work with that emergent system. And after all, human beings, Homo sapiens, is a very, very much relation-oriented mammal. And we know a lot about the severe disorders developing if people drop out of that relation system very early in life. So bringing that relation system back in psychotherapy, so that's one core factor of psychotherapy, a good psychotherapeutic relationship, might be one of the main factors of sustainable change.
So when you get psychotherapy in Germany, there are different schools, like there's psychoanalysis, for example, there's more the cognitive behavioral approach, there's systems psychotherapy. So do you have like any preferred direction, or do you think there's any school of psychotherapy that is most suited for understanding psychedelic therapy, or do you take like a completely new approach to be the most promising?
Yeah, thank you for the question. We are completely stepping out of the psychotherapy school war.
Yeah.
So We go. It's also not happening as much as it did 20 years ago. People are more relaxed when it comes to psychodynamics versus cognitive behavioral approaches. How are we stepping beyond that? We are working on the basis of the five-factor approach of general change mechanisms in psychotherapy. So some people might not know it, but there is a history of almost 70 years of psychotherapy research. It's often ignored by practitioners, but it's actually it's building like a lot of things are ignored by practitioners. But it's building the basis that is beneath those different schools of psychotherapy. I mentioned one factor already, that is of the five, that is therapeutic relationships. So in these large studies, you can clearly see that people that in a patient therapist relationship, if you don't have a well working psychotherapeutic relationship, the therapy doesn't work. Unspecific of the methods that therapists are using. Two others that I'd like to mention now is resource activation and problem activation. So, and there, by the way, psychodynamic schools and cognitive behavioral schools come together. So it's common in both schools to say if you have no problem activations within the therapy, usually things don't work. So what is problem activation? That in the therapy, the patient re-experiences at least part of, let's say, a traumatic situation. Yeah, that that she or he gets close to difficult feelings related to the problems that they present, and then you work with those with the activation of the actual activation in the brain, in the body. And try to transform it through psychotherapeutic interventions. So the question, the brief question to your answer is, we are based on general change mechanisms. And in our practice, in the OVID practice, we have cognitive behaviorally trained psychotherapists and psychodynamically trained psychotherapists. And we try to find a perfect personalized therapy concept for each patient.
And is the therapy then approached with a goal in mind, or is it, because I think there's maybe, or I was under the impression that in psychedelic therapy it's much more difficult to really plan out what an experience is going to be about, or is it more like working with what you get, basically what the psyche?
Yeah, first of all, a psychedelic therapy is not tripping. It's not identical. A therapy is much more. Yeah, and a therapy, a professional therapy, would always involve goals. We could specify your question, how specific are the goals defined? Yeah. So, of course, if a patient comes, he often wants to get rid of his symptoms, sometimes without work. Yeah, sometimes without wanting to get into the problem activation. Or sometimes the patient might want the therapist to solve his or her problems. This usually does not work. A therapist can't explain away the problems. So in the screening and preliminary sessions to a psychedelic session, a therapist would usually talk about goals. But it is quite common that after a session, like you said, the patient comes up with very different thoughts about how his problem evolved and how it might be changed. And then the goals often change. But goals would be picked up by our therapists usually so that the patient also can reassure herself, himself, about that she made progresses. So if you don't have any goal, if neither the therapist nor the patient has any goals, it's very hard to document progress.
Yeah, maybe like a more general question relating to the current state of psychiatry. So currently there's a lot of psychopharmaca already prescribed on a daily basis. And yeah, I don't know if you have a perspective on how psychedelics will factor into changing the landscape of psychiatry, if they will replace more the classical psychopharmaca, or will they augment them as well, or will they only work for a subgroup of people, or that a hope of, yeah, of transforming the landscape, yeah, yeah, in general?
Yeah, excellent question. So with my colleague and friend, Professor Gerhard Gründer, we have published, he has edited a special edition of the journal Pharmacopsychiatry with the title Psychedelics in Psychiatry 2021. That's a very good resource for everybody to dive into, a good review of everything going on there. Together with Gerd, I have written a text about the potential future of psychedelics in the mental health care of the future. What we say there is that the claims that psychedelics will revolutionize psychiatry will probably not come true. If you have a very radical view of revolutionize, some people say that the SSRIs and all the other practices will just be thrown out and everything will be psychedelics. But there are a large number of patients that will not be treated with psychedelics in the future. Not only patients in the psychotic indications, some borderline indications might not work. People with strong substance use, poly substance use disorders, that don't have the capacity to work with the effects of the psychedelics will not be treated with a psychedelic. So it will add another tool, another instrument to psychiatry and to psychotherapy. And we are just exploring how many patients can be treated. So even if you look at one indication, let's pin it down to one indication, depression. Because our episode study, Gerd Gründer is a principal investigator of that study in Mannheim, Central Institute of Mental Health, and it's also happening at the Charité University. Even there, we are not sure if it's like 20, 40, or 60% of patients with a depressive disorder who can be treated. But what's for sure already, even before the approval of a psychedelic as medicine, that it works very well, at least for a part of these patients. If you would ask me for a guess, and it's really a guess, it's not knowledge, it's not empirical knowledge, I would say between 40 to 50% of the patients in depression can well be treated with psychedelics. That would be a huge amount of patients if it comes true. Because worldwide, we have more than 300 million people diagnosed with depression. That's huge. That's one of the main mental health issues of our times.
Yeah, and during the COVID pandemic, these numbers have quite dramatically increased again, like for a lack of the connections that you also mentioned earlier.
Yeah, but there's a problem. One of the challenges that researchers and practitioners in the field face is like, the bottleneck is, of course, building reliable, trustworthy clinics or places where people can be treated. Now, some enthusiasts might say, well, just get the psychedelics out into the drinking water. Yeah. So, but there's nothing to expect from that, but a lot of harm to people. So some people do well with some shocking, evocative experience, but there are also a lot of people out there that really need care and need people to work with them on those dramatic effects of psychedelics. Bottleneck, how to build reliable contexts for psychedelics treatments, and also how to train enough psychotherapists and psychiatrists to do the treatment.
Yeah, maybe this is a good place to move a little bit away from the purely psychotherapeutic context to the more enculturation perspective on psychedelics and the creation of potentially of spaces that are also could be used for self-development and these kind of things. So I guess in the Silicon Valley culture around microdosing, we've now seen that psychedelics can quickly be picked up and kind of feed into this self-development, self-optimization narrative that is popular, especially in the United States. So maybe also relating to the whole question of how psychedelics might move to a like more capitalist perspective, and how like a legalization and enculturation of psychedelics might work under capitalism. So at the Insight Conference of the Mind Foundation, you are also frequently inviting investors and people from the industry to talk about this. But do you see any risk with this, like also a bit drifting in wrong directions?
Yeah, so from my perspective, you were asking like two different questions. The first question was about non-pathological or salutogenetic use of psychedelics. Let's come to that later. Let's talk about the psychedelic industry question. So what is the psychedelic industry at all? For a German-speaking audience, that sounds a little bit strange, maybe. I would say that the psychedelic industry is a term coined by investors in Silicon Valley and particularly in the United States to make the things a little bit larger than they are.
Yeah.
and to build a craze around psychedelics to earn a lot of money. Now you've used the word capitalist. Now you're talking to a capitalist here. I'm both. Actually, I'm both an idealist and a capitalist. So I have a very strong root in public health. I want to make people better. I'm in the field for creating change for people. Yeah, both in the clinical field and maybe also beyond the clinical field. Let's talk about that in a minute. But what I deeply despise is to just those organizations and those people who are just in it for the quick dollar. That's actually happening, and we can. It's not news that there is a psychedelic bubble in the world. People are heavily investing, driving up stock market courses, and then quickly getting out of their own companies and running away. So there has been an example of a company that was rated at the stock exchange with more than $1 billion, and the founder has taken some of that money, a lot of that money, very early before the company did come out with a product at all. So it's just hype. So we have to be careful. Now let's go into my capitalistic side myself. So I realized when coming from university and trying to build a company to get something going, that's not revolutionary, of course, that you need money. You need money to get the whole thing going. You need, we were basically working, as volunteers ourselves for 4 years, not making any money, not earning any money, just putting in time and putting in our own money. And now that we have started a clinic and we are also working on a molecule, it's very clear that you need amounts of money that no private person can just put in. Yeah. The bottleneck here, or the thing that we need to discuss is the money used for something that is valuable for society and for people, or is it just used to enrich people? If somebody goes through a 10 to 15 year process of drug approval, she may need 100 or 200 million euros. Yeah. And I have no problem with somebody really engaged in it, being successful, earning a lot of money. But I think the criterion that I am hinting at is something of value being produced, or is it just nonsense? Is it just cloudy stuff? No serotonergic psychedelic has been approved yet by the FDA or the EMA, the European Medicines Agency. Three companies are very close to phase three studies. Phase three studies would do the job if successful, but that's open. We are going to have to wait if that really works out. So far, it's building expectations. I'm very optimistic that that MDMA and psilocybin will be the first drugs to be approved, but it has to be shown. And the last part of the journey is the hardest. So the phase one, phase two, and building all that bubble that was successful. Yeah. Now we have to show that it really does the job for a patient clientele that is very diverse in different countries and that is not part of the psychedelic scene itself. Yeah. So capitalism, yes, you can do good things with it. So that's what I call social capitalism or productive capitalism. Some call it productive capitalism. So I consider myself, for example, and my colleagues, social entrepreneurs. And the definition is we want to show people that we can improve impact concepts, qualities like health, measured by real health outcomes with those companies, as opposed to companies that are just being built for the sake of money.
So, yeah, I just remember Michael Pollan, I think, in a podcast mentioned that he is expecting ketamine clinics to be built up in the US now with this increase of psychedelic therapy with ketamine, but it's more like in the context of these centers for wealthy people to have more of a recreational component to it where they can hang out and relax.
Yeah, and we wouldn't consider our clinic, the Ovid Clinic Berlin-Friedrichshain, to be a ketamine clinic, although that's the only substance we are using currently. We are just building the capacity for compassionate use of psilocybin, but we're not doing it yet. So we are doing real transformative psychotherapy work with the help of a psychedelic-like dissociative. We are not a ketamine clinic. And if you look into the United States, there are ketamine clinics where you have 20 people in one room and the ketamine flows through them. It's actually it's a pretty dystopian thing that you see there. People are being treated and treating themselves as machines that are repaired by a pharmaceutical.
Yeah, I guess it's also a frequent critique of the current way like psychiatry is functioning with this belief in this magical pill that can be an antidepressant, this SSRI, or some kind of medicine that you just push in the body and then you wait and...
Yeah. But let me respond to that. That's actually a very interesting metaphor, the magic pill. I think we have to be a little bit more critical. There is a magic pill narrative at the neurocognitist, neuroscientist side of things, a medical side of things, where people believe that everything is somatic and needs to be treated on the somatic level of things. Yeah, but there's also a magic pill narrative in the psychedelic field. So, and that works differently. It's more a metaphysic, a magic pill narrative, as if psychedelics would be substances that catapult people into a spiritual, kind of spiritual space, and everything will be okay. So, and there's also that one-shot narrative, one shot of psychedelics, and it works like 200 hours of psychotherapy. This is dysfunctional language. Yeah. This is really dysfunctional language. It doesn't, if you look at the reality of really, let's say, really sick people, very few of them get well with one shot of psychedelics, and because it's also very logical. If you look at psychological problems that all of us have, you and me and patients, they are kept up by our psychological systems. We come back to families, and our relatives may react to us in the same way than before. So that's keeping up symptoms. That's keeping up difficult behaviors. So behavioral change is much more complicated than just throwing a pill at a system. And then everything is okay. That also would be a nice bridge. I'm giving it back to you in a second. That's also a nice bridge to the cultural side of things. So what does have to happen in the context of a person using a psychedelic to get sustainable change going.
Yeah, there was one more interesting connection to the, yeah, also maybe cultural questions. So in the psychedelic community, there's this excitement around this idea that the Eleusinian mysteries and ancient Athens were also connected to psychedelic use, and that you had this prototypical society that was enlightened and put into these spiritual realms by use of psychedelics. So maybe a general point on that is like the question of how important that historical dimension actually is, and if we should reconnect with the past, because it seems to me that there's also this glorifying aspect of like glorifying that ancient classical Greece past that already happened during the Renaissance. But if you actually think about what the Athenian society was, they were like a very strong patriarchal structures. They still had slavery and all these kind of things. So this idea that psychedelics inherently give you this, this insight into how to behave properly and how to be a good human being also seems to be a bit flawed. So I was wondering where you stand on that, if you think that this dimension is important, or if we should just stick to the science, basically.
Well, history is very important, but there have been a couple of narratives, like Brian Murakami's book, where the Eleusis story is being picked up again, that are simply interpreted in a very naive way. Of course, early Greek society has not been a psychedelic society. Like the Eleusinian mysteries have always been a special thing also in this society. And they have been a marginalized, we would call it a marginalized group within the society. There have been religious movements around it. So we have to think deeper about that. The first group that has written about the Eleusinian Mysteria, was Albert Hofmann himself with Karl Rucker in the 1970s. Yeah, and now it's being picked up, but people make a metaphysical meta story out of it, building a new Bible. I think it's deeply naive. I would say that there has never been a psychedelic society. Even some of the Amazon tribes that are using psychedelics, I would be very cautious to call them a psychedelic society. It's always been only a part of their cultural practices. So if some people follow that thesis, we have to take a look at how the cultural practices around psychedelics are structured and what are healthy and what are unhealthy practices. I think let's start with just describing cultural spaces in modern society where psychedelics are already used or used frequently. And this is the festival scene, for example, and an underground therapy scene and an underground religious or spiritual workshop scene. These are common, I think, common contexts to many people listening, probably. And by saying that, in the way I did it, I think it's very clear that these are very small and marginalized groups, even now with the psychedelic renaissance going on. And the problem is how these groups and the experiences in the workshops or the festivals gathered there are being translated to everyday practice. When you come out of an ayahuasca retreat in Berlin or Amsterdam on a weekend, how do you communicate with your girlfriend when you go home, or with your family, with your study friends? Now, what I imagine could be healthy is, well, that's also the strategy of the Mind Foundation, that we concentrate a little bit more in the next years still on clinical application. And we already think about and maybe build structures for an application of psychedelics that is beyond treating people. That would be cultural or salutogenetic. Salutogenesis is how health develops. That's how you can. It's like the sister of pathogenetic, how a pathology develops. So I think that we need to institutionalize those practices. Just decriminalizing psychedelics and throwing it out into society, I'm not expecting a lot of good from that. Our societies are structured very differently from Amazonian tribes and from Greek society. People are already moving between different cultural contexts, coming from an Islam background, coming from a Christian background, moving from Norway to Germany, from the United States to Lithuania, and moving within our society. People now have to solve identity and life course questions that have not been present in any historical society. You have to reinvent yourself in the course of a lifetime several times, very often. Yeah, the spectrum of decisions that people need to make in their life today is so much broader than anything that has happened in the past. So I think the way that I imagine and I also want to contribute to is building centers of, we call them centers of Bewusstseinskultur, using the work of Thomas Metzinger, where people very mindfully work with their states of mind, where meditation would be integrated, where psychedelics could also be a part. While it's not a center of Bewusstseinskultur, would not be a place where people just step into the door and somebody throws psychedelics at them. So you would actually have, it would actually be more similar to the old concept of the Kurhaus, maybe going. So that's a German word for you go to a place where you reconsider all your life practices. You might go through a period of fasting. You might want to re-explore what you do in life by maybe taking a psychedelic and then make a plan how to change it afterwards. This involves a lot of cultural practices that are not in place when people just drop LSD on Saturday night at 2 o'clock. In a dance temple.
Yeah, so I'm also now mindful of your time, but maybe we can quickly connect this whole idea of Bewusstseinskultur to this idea of like a secular spirituality and this maybe also some like general issues in our societies, that there's a certain lack of connection felt and like a spiritual dimension lacking, and how psychedelics might help with that.
Yeah. So, spirituality is important. Spirituality, then again, spirituality is an empty concept. We need to define it. We need to talk to each other what we mean by that. Very often when people are using the term spirituality, they mean something very important, a meaningful experience related to how they understand life in general. But there are also groups that use the word spiritual or spirituality and mean we connect to a metaphysical being. Yeah. And there is a lot of esoteric stuff also going on. That's why I think that a secular spirituality could be something that could evolve from the scientific psychedelic space. What does secular mean? Secular mean in that context? So attending to all the pain issues that life involves, attending to being here, not escaping, not buying into escapism, also not buying into metaphysical escapism. Although people might experience things like talking to a being or in the phenomenology of psychedelics, it's very hard to be absolutely sure that this being is a real metaphysical being living in a world beyond. Even if we would consider that something like that exists, and that it's not only a cultural narrative that people hypnotize themselves with, even if we consider, people have to answer the question why these other beings in this other world are not the same in every culture and are not being revisited on a regular basis and things like that. So I think it's very sound if we want to make this world better, and want to maybe survive on this world with all its challenges on the ecological side and whatever, that we do not build a psychedelic culture that is completely focused on the vague concept of spirituality, because spirituality needs to be criticized. We invest in the West, we have a culture of hundreds of years of religious critique of religion. We should not get into another now called spiritual practice that is simply by being there, evolving into another religion, where guru-like leaders are playing games on people. Guru-like leaders know how the world is. Unfortunately, modern times have shown us that we know very, very little about this world, physically and psychologically. And so if religion, if one part of religion or religious traditions was assuring people that they know how the world is, and they even know what happens after death, a secular psychedelic inspired spirituality would build more on, would build a more decent and like attitude that does not suggest to people that they know everything. What makes it more complex is that in the course of a psychedelic experience, people sometimes have very convincing, very that's the reality like experiences.
Yeah.
But I think there is a way that people can deal with these experiences and outside of these experiences, gratefully relate to these without telling people that that's the reality. Because if you look at it from a little bit of historical distance, people have had these convincing experiences outside of psychedelics throughout religious history. Moses, the Ten Commandments, he knew exactly who his God was and that he was the chosen one and that he had the rules in his hand, how people would survive. So that's nothing new. And I'm simply a little bit, cautious when it comes to people building these movements around psychedelics that seem so religious.
Yeah.
So secularity also involves being part of modern society, critical reassessment of yourself and others, and not telling people that you have found the truth.
Yeah, I think these are already great final words, but I have like one final question that I like to ask because it always gives some interesting input. So do you have like a favorite book, probably in the maybe like in the context of psychedelics in general, that influenced you the most or changed your thinking or you found really insightful?
If you allow me not answering your question directly, so I would not give people a psychedelic book, but a book that has lately been very influential for me is Peter Godfrey Smith's writing. So that's an Australian. He has a chair for the philosophy of science in biology. He has written books like Other Minds and Metazoa. And if you read Metazoa, you actually if you're always looking for inspiration for psychedelics, you find a lot, because he is following the evolution of consciousness throughout biological evolution, and comes in with a theory that not only humans have complex forms of consciousness, but it's all over the animal and non-animal world. And I would just drop that to people. And if they want like a compendium of interesting books and papers, I would invite people to go to the website of the Mind Foundation and type the word psychedelic compendium into the search function, and you'll find a lot of interesting and crazy stuff.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. So thanks a lot for your time and this very interesting conversation.
Thanks a lot for the great questions.